From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in Radio West, we're talking about an amazing woman in the Middle East. She's the first woman judge on Palestine's Court of Islamic Law. Her name is Khaloud Al-Faqih, and she's the subject of Utah filmmaker Erica Cohn's documentary, which is screening in Salt Lake City this week. The film is a portrait of this remarkable woman, but also about how Sharia law is misunderstood. We'll be right back.
Benjamin Franklin said, "Tell me and I forget. Teach me and I may remember. Involve me and I learn." That sums up KUER's community calendar pretty well. You'll learn new things, like how to make your own honey, or write a story, or arrange flowers. There are new events every week, and if you've got something you want to show people, you can post your own events too. Check out the community calendar under the events tab at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Khaloud Al-Faqih is a pistol. I think that's the right word. You know, smart, self-assured, assertive, a woman who knows what she wants, doesn't take any crap. Khaloud lives in the West Bank, in Ramallah, and we meet her in Utah filmmaker Erica Cohn's latest documentary. For years, she had worked as a lawyer, representing women in domestic violence cases. But Khaloud was determined to become a judge in the Sharia court system. And when she told the Chief Justice that, he just burst out laughing. There were no women judges in that system. Some Islamic scholars and clerics believed there never had been, never should be. Women, they said, were constrained by their emotions, their biology, and besides, it went against Islamic law. So Khaloud started to study. She wanted to see if, in fact, Sharia law prohibited women from being judges. And what she found and what the film portrays is that women in the Middle East are being held back, being treated unequally, not because of the actual law, but because of centuries of traditions and misinterpretations of that law. Erica Cohn's film is called The Judge. It's opening tonight in Salt Lake City. Today in the program, we're talking about the film. Cohn is a Utah-based filmmaker. She co-directed In Football We Trust, which premiered at the 2015 Sundance Film Festival. We'll give you details about when the film opens a little bit later on the program. We began our conversation with the moment Erica first met Khaloud Al-Faqih. She says she was instantly captivated by the woman.
I was on a shooting hiatus with my last film, In Football We Trust, and when I had received this Rotary Ambassadorial Scholarship to teach film in Israel-Palestine and continue some of my postgraduate research in Islamic feminism, I had no intention of making a film. I had my hands full with In Football We Trust and loved that process. But one day, a dear friend and colleague had invited me to this Islamic reform meeting that was happening in Ramallah at the Palestinian Authority headquarters. And I found myself, as most filmmakers do, in, you know, an amazing situation where I was seated at a table full of men in tarbouches, the hats that judges and sheikhs wear, and I was looking at pictures of Yasser Arafat throughout the years and maps of Palestine throughout history, and all of a sudden Judge Khaloud walked in. And she took my breath away. In that moment, everyone stood to greet her. And she had, as you said, this unbelievable presence that just kind of radiated throughout the room. And as I listened to her speak about issues of raising the marriage age and polygamy and divorce and inheritance and custody and how to create uniformity with Palestinian law, within Palestinian law, when there is no uniformity of borders. And how, you know, she really wanted to create change for women, I wanted to know more. And so after this meeting, we had a chance to officially engage. And I found out that she used to be a lawyer representing women who were survivors of domestic violence and felt like she could best catalyze change within the Sharia courts and had turned to the Sharia text to be able to prove this. I was beyond captivated. And I said I was a filmmaker. And she said, "Well, why don't you come into my courtroom and see what that's like?" Yeah. And Doug, the second that I walked into her courtroom was like all the film kind of came to me in a minute. And then I watched her adjudicate, you know, 40 to 60 cases that day and was acting as part judge, part lawyer, part marital therapist, part counselor. And the cases that she was seeing are actually not so dissimilar to the cases that we have here in the U.S. dealing with family issues. And after that day, I told Khulud, I think we should make a film. And your experiences really provide a nuanced understanding of Sharia and provide imagery of strong Muslim women, which we rarely get to see in the Western world. And also, we can together present a portrait of Palestine that a lot of people will never experience.
Yeah.
And she said, well, that's amazing, Erica, because I've been looking for ways to exponentially reach women and girls around the world, and I've been waiting for someone to come along and let's do this.
So, I mean, what you just said, there's a lot there.
Yeah.
So what did you think this was going to be about? I mean, because in some ways, it's personal. It's about her life. We get to meet her parents, and we get a sense of her, I guess, struggle is maybe some way to put it, to sort of prove that her idea of being a judge was absolutely in keeping with Islamic law. She makes that case, and we'll get to that here in a second. But what did you figure this was about? Because there's a lot going on here. And how did you start thinking, all right, I need to start fine-tuning the essence of what this might be?
I wanted to convey the feeling that I had when I first met her, because it's this incredible presence. And that was, I will say, one of the biggest challenges is how do you create a feeling, an immersive experience into a, you know, a two-dimensional screen.
Yeah.
And part of that, as I came to learn more about Judge Khulud, was her work as a judge outside of the courtroom. And no other judge is really going to neighbors, paying house calls, talking to women's groups about educating people about their rights. And as I started learning more about Khulud's life and how she spent her time and how she was able to compartmentalize her work and be an incredible mother and wife and daughter and family member, I mean, all these verite moments started appearing in my head, and I wanted to pay tribute to the fact that she's a working, amazing mother.
Who makes school lunch before she heads to court.
Yes.
Right?
Some of which the kids don't like.
Yeah. Yeah.
And also for this film to be a mirror for us as Americans, to see ourselves in Khulud, yep, and for people in the Middle East to see themselves in Khulud.
I want to ask you about that particular point, too. This idea that, I mean, if you think about the Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court, there haven't been women on that Supreme Court all that long. There aren't that many in comparison these days. Three we have now. For a while, it was only one. For a while, it was only two. And it made me wonder if this kind of resistance to, and which is something that comes up in the film, the idea that, look, women can't separate their emotions from logic and all those kinds of really dated ideas. But it made me think, gosh, in some ways, and there's a lot of important differences, but in some ways, there are a lot of parallels and similarities, it seems, in these cultures.
Yeah, there's a tremendous amount of parallel. And when I was interviewing people on the street and kind of getting their opinions about women's leadership and also Khulud being the first woman judge in the Sharia courts, people frequently said, oh, yes, women are too emotional. And women would say this. Yeah. And I think that women are often our own worst enemies. We can be our own worst enemies. And that's what you saw throughout the Hillary Clinton campaign. The same sort of rhetoric. Women are too emotional. They cannot be in politics. They cannot be in legal positions or, you know, very prestigious leadership roles.
Yeah. The other thing I wanted to ask you about is I know you grew up exposed somewhat to a kind of orthodox conservative environment, in this case, Mormon. And I'm wondering, in what way do you think that influenced how you were thinking about what you were seeing in, among the Palestinians, and how you were thinking about the film, you know, in terms of gender roles and attitudes and ideas about women and where they fit in religious ideas? You know, because Mormonism has, in some ways, it's said, some fairly orthodox ideas about a woman's place. I'm wondering if you made connections there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I will say that even as much as we as filmmakers distance ourselves from the stories and try to be objective, these stories are pieces of ourselves. And, you know, I'm fascinated by the tension and intersect of religion and culture and identity. And because that's where I, you know, started my process in filmmaking. I grew up here in Salt Lake, coming from an interfaith family, part Jewish, part Christian, and never belonging to the predominant faith. You know, at that time in Salt Lake was predominantly Mormon. It's changed significantly since, but I felt a lot of the socio-cultural religious alienation and wanted to be able to find a way to discuss and to be able to process those kinds of feelings and what it means to be a woman amidst all of this. And actually what's so fascinating is before I met Khulood, I felt like it wasn't possible to create change within a religious construct and that religion wasn't exactly a place for feminism to be discussed. And through Judge Khulood, I found out that that's actually not true, that is absolutely not true, that you can work within a religious construct, which may to the outside world seem rather rigid, but that you can create change from within. Judge Khulood does just that.
It seems like that is one of the important themes of the film, that she is dealing with the realities of this religious culture, trying to work within that reality and understanding it, respecting it. And that seems to be, in some ways, her strategy, almost.
It's important to note that it's culture and traditional norms that are affecting how Islam is being interpreted.
But I think that's the distinction, right? Is that there is the actual law itself, religious law, how it works, what it actually says on the paper, and the way people interpret it and the way customs and traditions filter it, because there's a difference.
Yes, absolutely. And patriarchy has kind of written women out of these historical roles that they've had, and specifically in Islam, throughout the history of the religion. And it's, you know, trying to find ways to revive that history and to continue to that history through women's leadership in new forms.
I think this is a good time to bring in Professor Asifa Qureshi Landes, a legal scholar, specializes in comparative Islamic and U.S. constitutional law, teaches at the University of Wisconsin Law School, joining us from Wisconsin Public Radio in Madison. And Professor, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi. Thanks for inviting me.
I think this is a good time to bring you into this part of the conversation. And I guess what Eric and I have been talking about, and that is the difference between, you know, what it actually what Islamic law actually says and the way it might be practiced or the way it's perceived. Let's begin there and how you perceive the distinctions, the differences.
One of the things that I liked especially about this movie was that it gave a much more nuanced presentation of Sharia than you usually get. And it usually is somewhat along the lines of the way you described it, the law, what is written on the page. And that's actually not the whole picture. If you do any kind of digging into Sharia, there's many, many different interpretations and schools of law, classical schools of law, as well as modern reform interpretations as well that are also out there. And so what she was working with was that diversity within the reality of the legal realm of Sharia. So it's not like one code, one monolithic book, and you look it up and there's the rule, which she realized and she probably knew for a long time. And so when she looks in and finds that there is a school, a pretty well-established school that allows women to be judges, that's what she focused on. And she was able to make change by articulating that view. Now, that's not the only view, as you saw also in the movie, but it's a strongly held, respected view within the legal community of classical Islamic law. So she was able to make that argument. And so I think you're right that it was her strategy to work within the existing respected collection of Islamic legal interpretation. But I also think it was her identity. I don't think it was a stretch. She thought of herself as a practicing Muslim. And so she was interested in women's rights, but she didn't question that women's rights would be consistent with Islam. And so she just dug and dug and found, you know, the way that she could articulate that in tangible form.
Erica, tell that story. She comes to the Chief Justice of the Sharia Court. And he laughs when she says she wants to be a part of that court. It just didn't seem heard of. And to his credit, he's an interesting character in the film. He says basically what? Make your case, right? And she does.
Well, let me go back in time just a little bit.
Okay.
Judge Khulood started announcing publicly that she was going to become the first woman judge in the Middle East Sharia courts when she was 25.
Yeah.
This was a
pretty
reality.
Pretty audacious, right?
Yeah. This was a reality for her at a young age. And then she began turning to the Sharia text. And then she began studying to pass the judicial written and oral exam. And she talked to Sheikh Taysir Tamimi, who was the current Qadi al-Quda, or Chief Justice, about this numerous times. And the first time when she walked into his office and told him, didn't ask, told him that she was going to be the first woman judge, he laughed at her.
Yeah.
And she said, no, I'm dead serious. And this is what I'm going to do. Keep an eye out. And then she later took the judicial exam. And I think that people really felt, the judicial committee felt like, okay, we'll allow her to take this exam. But there's no way she would ever pass it. And she far surpassed everyone else who took that exam. And Sheikh Taysir Tamimi became her champion.
Yeah. What was the case she was making? Let's talk about the case. What she goes back into law, because there's this really crucial question that comes up early in the film, and that is, why couldn't a woman be a judge for a Sharia court? What would be keeping her? Where does it say in the law that she couldn't? So talk about that.
Well, it's a matter of interpretation. Palestine, it's under the Abu Hanifa Islamic school of thought. And there is nothing that the Hanafi Islamic school of thought says against women jurists. And so, you know, it's more of a traditional and cultural norm to prevent women from being these judges. And Palestine has had a strong women's movement, has been a part of the feminist movement for hundreds of years, even before our feminist movement in the U.S. Began. And so, you know, she put all these pieces together and was wondering, well, why is kind of the religion, the religious courts, the last bastion of patriarchy in this way and women's leadership? And went to the Hanafi interpretation and said, this is acceptable, and was able to prove to Sheikh Taysir Tamimi that that was acceptable. And there had been women jurists long, hundreds and thousands of years before.
Professor, say a little bit more about that, if you would, too. This particular interpretation, what does it, how does it account for women and their role in civil society?
Well, as Erica said, women have been jurists of Islamic law from the beginning. That has actually historically not been a barrier. There's some barriers to sort of ritual leadership and political leadership historically, but as far as scholars of Sharia itself, scholars of fiqh, the actual doctrine of Sharia, women have been scholars. Some of the founding schools of thought were taught by women scholars. So that's not, it's never historically been a barrier. Now, their books aren't the ones that are typically translated and published and, you know, republished, but they're there. If you look in the biographical dictionaries of women scholars, they're there, and jurists of law. And in fact, judges. There's a great story about a judge in 10th century Baghdad. And she was a woman. She was appointed. And she got some resistance from the community, but she was pretty strategic. And she arranged for a male faqih, a male scholar, to sit with her for a few days. And after he did that, the people took her seriously. And then he left. And she was a judge in Baghdad in the 10th century. So there's a history of this. And I think Erica's right that it's just cultural norms of the modern period that have created this resistance, but there isn't really a legal resistance, at least within the Hanafi school specifically says women can be judges. And then there's not a resistance among any of the schools for women to be jurists and scholars of this law.
Asifi Qureshi Landis is a professor of law at the University of Wisconsin Law School. Erica Cohn directs the new documentary film called The Judge, which opens tonight at the Broadway Center Cinemas in downtown Salt Lake City. We should mention tonight and tomorrow night, Erica is going to be on hand for a Q&A following the 7 o'clock screenings. You can get information about that and tickets by going to our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about a remarkable woman in the Middle East. She's the first woman judge on Palestine's Court of Islamic Law. Her name is Khalud al-Faqih, and she's the subject of Utah filmmaker Erica Cohn's latest documentary, which is opening tonight in Salt Lake City. It's called The Judge. Take us to, as the film opens up, The sensibility, Erica, of women have been judges in criminal courts in Palestinian area for, you know, for a number of years, since the 70s. But for some reason, there was a distinction between an administrative criminal court and a Sharia court. Explain what the difference is here, because it seems like this is about adjudicating these really personal family issues.
Yes. Well, post-colonization, most countries in the Middle East were split up legally into the Sharia courts, which dealt with family issues, and then the civil or criminal courts. And so you see this distinction within Israel as well. You have the rabbinic courts and you have the Sharia courts or the Christian courts, as well as the other kind of legal system. And so in Palestine, you've had women who have been judges and lawyers for decades. So why not it within the family courts? And it's fascinating when you look at other countries and how they're interpreting Sharia. Oftentimes women are not allowed to adjudicate divorce. It's kind of this very taboo thing for women to be at the forefront of divorcing a couple. So Khulud felt like her presence as a judge would not only be able to provide a platform for women to feel more comfortable coming forward with their claims. It's very taboo for women to talk about domestic violence or sexual abuse that they experience. And Khulud's presence definitely has changed that dynamic, but also making sure that women know their rights. Because according to Sharia, women have, you know, so many rights that they could be using. But the law never actually benefits people who don't know their rights.
There's a great scene where one woman said, look, we could lose our children if we waive our rights. And she's like, no, you don't know what you're talking about. That's not how it works. And so this idea of these misconceptions coming from this lack of education, from women actually knowing where they fit in the scheme of things, it seems like that's an important theme in the film.
Yes. You know, Khulud says women don't know what they don't know. And we have to be our own advocates and we have to educate each other about our rights. And one of my favorite kind of moments in the film is you see, you know, couples getting married and talking about the prenuptial agreements, essentially. And that's something that's so taboo here in the U.S. We don't talk ahead of time about how we envision a marriage or what kind of rights should be upfront and discussed within that marriage. And, you know, Khulud points out you can describe, you know, the life you want to live, where you want to live, what kind of education you want to have, how many children you want to have, whether or not you can have additional wives, which is up for debate and interpretation among many different jurists and scholars. But that's kind of a revolutionary concept, both in the Middle East and here.
Yeah. Professor, would you comment more on that, this idea of arranging these marriage contracts, which seems so, I have to say, it seems so enlightened and so fascinating that these women are working out like, no, this is the deal. This is how this is going to work.
It's so typically Islamic law like to me when I saw that, because the marriage contract in Islam is actually, Islamic law has always been treated as first and foremost a contract.
Yeah.
It's got a religious component to it and spiritual component, but it really is treated by the jurors as a contract. And so it's two people coming together to build a life together, and they're very pragmatic about, well, here, put in all the conditions you want to set this up and think about things like who's going to do what, and is it going to be polygamous or monogamous, and is who's going to have what rights to divorce, and where are you going to live, and education, and all these kinds of things. And so it goes way back to the earliest times of Islamic history, where you have complicated terms that are put in these contracts that very well set out how this couple is going to live. And so it is true that a lot of the default rules in fiqh and the Islamic legal doctrine are lean towards more power for the husband. So access to divorce is easier for him. And
yeah.
His various rights during marriage, all of that, like the right to polygamy. But if you put it in your marriage contract, you could actually write a marriage contract that is the most egalitarian feminist marriage contract that would be upheld by a Muslim judge. So the point of educating women on those rights is actually front and center to a lot of Muslim women activism in the Muslim world today, is getting the average Muslim woman to know what she can put in her contract. Because if it's in the contract, you've protected that woman, even if you're having trouble getting political movement at the national level. But at an individual level, you can protect individual women that way. So that was very – I was smiling when I saw that, because I was like, yep, that makes a lot of sense that she would be focusing on that as a way to get people to know their rights.
Well, and this comes up early in the film when Judge Khulod is talking to this woman, and she's saying, look, this is the way it works. He can't mm-hmm. really do anything about it. This is the law. It's laid down. And what I loved about that is it just didn't seem so arbitrary based on customs. Like, this is law.
Right. Well, and I wanted to say something about this, and Erica said this earlier, about using – looking to Islam as a strategy and as looking at a place for your rights. And this is a very important thing for, I think, Western women to realize, is that very often Sharia is presented as the enemy to women's rights. Right. And unfortunately, that plays out in Muslim-majority countries as well. So the people who are working on women's rights often speak about Islam and speak about Sharia in a negative way. So it creates this dichotomy and this polarization. You're either for women's rights, and that means you're against Islam or Sharia, or you're for Islam, and therefore you're against women's rights. And right. so it ends up in this very unfair space for people who say, wait, within Sharia, I have all these rights. I want to work with my religious language and my religious identity for things that I believe are my right. And so it's very telling to me that Khulod, who cared about women and cared about women's empowerment, she did not take the approach that a Western woman might expect, like, oh, let's get rid of the Sharia. Let's get rid of these Sharia courts. They're bad for women. No, she went in and said, I'm gonna own this. I'm gonna be a part of this, and I'm gonna revive those aspects of Islamic law that are helpful to women. I'm gonna make sure women know about them. And so, therefore, she went to be a judge in that very court that many Westerners look at, saying, "There's no hope there. Let's just get rid of them."
Yeah. Spend a little bit more time on this, because I know you've been writing recently about the kind of current feminist strategy, mm-hmm. which says Sharia law is just untenable. We can't really work around it. And you say that's created, I think you were mentioning this here a moment ago, this kind of unnecessary war.
Yeah.
And say a little bit more about this, because what you're trying to say, your alternative to that is – I think this is how you put it. You said, don't even mention Islamic law at all?
If you're a secular feminist, or if you're an NGO that works from a secular sort of funding, you're coming from the West, and you're coming in to, quote unquote, help Muslim women. I mean, right there, there's a little bit of paternalism there, like, I'm rescuing these poor Muslim women. But anyway, you know, if you want to help, I understand there's a positive motivation to help when you see people that you think, you know, they could be in a better state. But what happens is it creates this, like I said, this polarized attitude about women's rights that it's only a Western thing. And colonialism is very fresh memory for these communities. Right? So if anything looks like it's a new form of colonialism, it is going to be immediately resisted. So if it looks like that's what you're doing, you are hurting the very cause that you're trying to push, which is women's rights. So I would like to see more space built for local indigenous communities speaking within whatever language works for their community. And if it's a majority Muslim population, Sharia is going to be a language that resonates with that population. Let those people work on making the arguments and the strategy. In many, many times, I've seen the goals are the same. It's just the way you argue for the goals are different from a secular versus Islamic perspective. So if, say, the goal is access to education, that is a clearly established Islamic value. There's Quranic verses about the right to education for both men and women. As I mentioned, there were Muslim women scholars going back from the beginning. So it's easy to work on access to education. And you just work with Muslim arguments coming from the Muslim community to make those strides. If anything is done to give the impression that women's rights are a Western thing, you are taking away exactly the kind of argument you want to give to these people. So you don't want to make it look like anyone working for women's rights is a sellout to the West. That's the main problem.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's what Judge Khulod is doing.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah,
there's
you
can't look at her and say she's a sellout to the West in any
no,
possible way.
So true.
Well, what I think is so interesting is there's this, you know, debate in the film. Also, you hear Hanan Ashrawi say, you know, I'm worried about what's happening in the Sharia courts. They can be very unjust to women.
Right.
But ultimately, it comes down to representation. And it's the same thing here in the U.S. You have to have equal representation in who is implementing, interpreting, influencing the law. I mean, the law will never reflect the population in which it's supposed to serve unless there's equal representation.
Mm-hmm. All right. Yeah, and that's what's something that people don't appreciate about Sharia itself is that, like I said, it's all these multiple interpretations. That comes from the basic building blocks of the nature of Islamic jurisprudence, that there is this belief by the jurists from the beginning that they are only human and they're doing their best guess, basically, their best approximation of what God's law is. But they never speak as if they're speaking for God. So they always use terminology that accommodates that they're probably right, but there's possibility that they're wrong. And so that right there brings in the reality that brought in all those different schools of law. And so that reality still exists. So just because it's in the doctrine somewhere, everyone who knows anything about Islamic law recognizes that it's human and therefore fallible. So anyone who does the work that Khulud was doing can put their interpretation on the table and say, here's my ijtihad, here's my interpretive work, here's an equally legitimate interpretation. And that's how you get the evolution of Islamic law over time to accommodate for different times and places that existed. Because it's the epistemological, to use a very academic word there, but the nature of what they know, they appreciated that they were fallible. And so anything they wrote was fallible. And so therefore, anybody else, if they're willing to do the work, can put their interpretation right on the table next to everybody else's.
I noticed this a number of times. Early on, there's a scene where these three Palestinian men are testifying for a woman whose husband has not been providing spousal support or child support. And Judge Khulud is adjudicating this. And she asks him to stand and take this oath. And she says, you are standing alone before God. And there's this kind of constant invoking of God along the way. And these oaths and the way they're presented. How does that square with what you just said? I mean, and it goes to the question of how you separate, you know, church and state, or the idea of the place of God in comparison to the place of law. How does that separation or that mixture work?
That's why I think it was so complicated for her to get a seat on one of these benches, because in a Sharia court is specifically a world of trying to apply what they understand as God's law. And so the doctrine that's written by the jurists, as Erica said, the Hanafi law is what's predominant in Palestine. So the Hanafi school of law is what then has been the doctrine that these courts follow. So unlike common law, where the judges are essentially making law, I mean, we don't like to talk about it that way, but essentially we look at case precedent and what the Supreme Court says, it might change the law based on the judges doing it. And in Islamic law, it doesn't work exactly like that. The law is written by jurists that are basically private entity scholars, and those are the books that they write. And the judges then just apply that law. So they're not doing the interpretive work that I just described. They're the appliers of that work. And so within that world, it is very much a place where the laws applied are they understand to be what God has directed individuals to live by. And so in the courtroom, you'll see an oath, very, very common, you know, would you swear by God that you're telling the truth? That's a very common thing to see in a Sharia court setting. Her active engagement, I liked the way Erica said she was part lawyer, part, you know, judge, part counselor. That's actually, from my research, also pretty typical to the classical period. We don't see judges behaving like we would in our contemporary American courts, where they're mostly a referee between lawyers who are really doing all the work. Yeah. Classical judges, qadis, typically were much more investigative and trying to find out what happened. And they're actually factual adjudicators as well as legal adjudicators. So they often would be very interactive with the witnesses and asking direct questions. So that all fit with what I understood to be a typical Sharia tribunal setting.
What's so fascinating also about the Sharia courts is they're much more efficient than our other courts.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, when you have 60 cases in a day, you have to be able to get to the root of the issue immediately and to be able to, you know, figure out a best solution. And maybe that's, you know, through marital counseling or other, you know, talking to family members. But it's not necessarily, you know, it's much more efficient. It's much more fast.
Right.
And Khulud says, you know, we like to achieve quick justice here, and justice is beautiful. And also just I'm remembering the scene that hit the cutting room floor that was so beautiful, that really described how Sharia is a living, breathing legal system that is adapted to our time and place. And Judge Khulud and her best friend Judge Esmahan, who was appointed after Judge Khulud, were discussing, you know, how to reform and how to discuss some of the laws now dealing with social media. How do you deal with Facebook, like courting and dating and marriage and divorce? And how do you deal with DNA evidence now? And how to reform some of the custody laws, because, you know, a lot of the work responsibilities with the home have now been divided or are now approached in a more egalitarian way.
Right. Well, yeah. the role of a judge is an interesting role. This goes a little bit back to your separate church and state question, because the judge wears the hat of the state. The state appoints them. But like I said, the law they apply is coming from these scholarly books that are establishing the doctrine. It's a little bit different in a modern state where some of it's legislated. But the idea that the judge is wearing that state hat, I think, is important to recognize that the role of the state, classically speaking, has always been to do the public good for the society. That's their main job, keep people safe and orderly. And so it is accepted that the judge may adjust the application of the doctrine for the particular litigants to make sure that the general good has been accomplished, that they're serving good for that particular couple. So a lot of the movement of law happens with this interaction of judges and the doctrine, seeing how is this playing out on the ground. And these exact questions that you just described are the kinds of things that are pushing the doctrine to move forward. And it will keep happening in exactly the way she described, making it relevant to the time and place.
Yeah, when I got the sense that that's what a judge is supposed to do, right? A judge is supposed to apply this kind of wisdom and common sense. And when they're talking to the particular litigants to say, look, just calm down, or you've got to think about your kid, or something I don't think you'd see in American judicial system in the same way, it seems. I don't know, maybe that's not entirely true, but that she absolutely was applying these kind of basic. She was a counselor. She was scolding sometimes, but you know, she was a judge. She's trying to be wise.
Yeah, I haven't been in enough family courtrooms here, but yeah, I get the feeling they're much more formal. They're much more sort of austere.
Yeah.
And I think her strength was being able to be respected as firm, and she held the control of that room. But at the same time, she was accessible and personal.
Which I will say is very different from some of her colleagues' rooms. I mean, I observed some of the other judges' courtrooms and also some of the other women judges. And there's just something that's really, really unique about Judge Khulood. And she carries out justice very swiftly and in a way that makes people feel like they can really relate to her. She's approachable.
Where does she get that? Seems like it comes from her folks. Like we see her parents. Are they goat farmers? Is that – do they –
They're not, but they love goats.
Okay, they love goats. So there are goats. And they have 12 kids. And I love it because they themselves, her parents, are not particularly educated. But as we hear from her father, it was really important to him that his children go to university. And not just his male children, but in particular his female children. Talk a little bit about that, because that seems to give us a clue as to where Judge Khulood is coming from.
One of my favorite quotes in the film is when her father says, "My primary goal was to arm my daughters with education. Education is a weapon."
Yeah.
And that is so beautiful. It's so universal. It's global. All of us can relate to that. I don't think that her father is an anomaly. I don't think that her parents are anomalies in Palestinian society. Palestine is one of the most well-educated places in the Middle East. But her parents are so unique. They are so proud in the way that they talk about her. They really instilled a sense of courage and confidence in her at a young age, which is key to someone's success.
I wanted to say something about the men in this movie. I want to thank you, Erica, for portraying Muslim men like that. Too often it is portrayed that the men are the problem and all brown men are oppressing brown women, and that's why, you know, we have to rescue them. And her dad was awesome, and he focused on education for his daughters. So did my dad, by the way, as a Muslim male figure. I mean, education for his daughters was very, very important. I learned at an early age that if I wanted to make an argument, it made sense for me to make an Islamically based argument to get what I wanted.
Right.
I want to go away to college.
Right.
I go back to the Quran that talks about education. I'm going to get a lot more traction with my dad if I quote the Quran to go away to college than anything else. He didn't care what the UN had to say, but the Quran, that mattered.
Yes.
And also her husband. Her husband was awesome. Her husband is a lawyer and had absolutely no problem with his wife being a judge and senior to him. And he was supportive and great. And then the Chief Justice, who, you know, certain aspects of his life I personally don't like. I'm not a fan of polygamy, but I had to recognize that he was very enlightened and saw truth when it was presented to him and was her champion, even apparently at the cost of his own job. So these are men who see justice, see women for who they are in their, you know, most powerful role in society, and are not and threatened and scared by it at all. And I agree with you. They're not anomalies. The Muslim world is filled with men like this.
this raised the question for me of the relationship that she had, the way she talked about, I think, troubling stagnant waters, wanting to throw a rock in stagnant waters. Like, and she even described it at some point to a group of women that what we need is a social revolution, is what she was talking about. So this idea of her being assertive, I guess this is just part of her character and who she always is.
I think so. I mean, she's been this way from a very young age. And speaking with her parents, I mean, she's been so courageous and so revolutionary from the time she knew how to read and write. Always being at the forefront of change. And what I think is so crucial, and what she's saying in this women's groups and to women on her neighbor visits and house calls, that women have to be at the forefront of this change. We cannot wait for politicians to absorb our cause. We have to be at the forefront of it, and we need a revolution that we are going to lead.
I want to ask you about some of the perceptions that we see from others throughout the film. There's a scene from a lawyer's break room that you went into, and these lawyers were speaking really candidly, these men, saying it's always on the men that suffer in these situations because women are bent on defying religious norms. They are too emotional. It's not logical thinking in the same way. So it's interesting to hear these lawyers talk about how they're seeing things. And as one lawyer puts it, my job is to fix the woman and send her back to the husband. So just talk a little bit about, because that does seem like one of those things that these women are absolutely up against in this system.
Yeah, one of the lawyers actually says, no man would ever cause problems with his wife. And, you know, you just have to laugh. Because I think...
Well, they did. Where I saw it, the audience laughed at that point.
Was that right?
Yeah.
It's a laugh
line. I mean, these are
yeah.
the same issues that we're dealing with here in the U.S. And, you know, that the women need the fixing and that women have been disobedient or that women are, you know, straying away from the family. And that is just, I mean, that goes back to patriarchy. I don't think that has anything to do with the religious courts.
But let's be honest, there is an element of patriarchy that still does exist in this system. And you see it in the language, for example, as she's talking to women, you know, you were not disobedient to his will. So this idea of obedience comes up, the idea of nashes. I'm not sure if that's pronounced properly, but this idea,
yeah.
Nashes, where a woman voluntarily leaves the house without any motivation or something that can disqualify her from this process. Would you talk a little bit about that? Because this is prevalent in the film.
Yeah, I will say, you know, you see in the film a woman swearing in the Quran and saying that she was not disobedient to his will. But, you know, what Khulood is getting at in this meeting is, was there any straying away from the marriage? Was there anything that you have done that could contribute to the falling apart of the marriage, which she also asks men.
Yeah, right. She adjudicates it fairly. It's not, there's no difference in that way. I think that's important because you do see both of those things. Eric, I wanted you to talk about this moment. I'm not sure how much you want to give away, but what seems to be this turning point in the story, the Chief Justice that we were talking about, who had been so enlightened about allowing a woman to be a judge on the Sharia court, he's forced to retire. And another chief justice, a far more orthodox conservative person, takes his place. And things begin to really change. And then you start to see – and he changes the structure of the court. No longer is this woman adjudicating these family issues, applying her sense of justice in that way. Now she's just basically signing forms and doing administrative stuff. It really hits her. Her morale, she calls it a living hell, I think.
Yeah, she talks about how difficult it is to be a judge who doesn't see cases, who's just doing administrative work. And for her, I mean, her presence in the courts was so crucial to have change within the system. And it felt like a betrayal to her overall goal. It felt like a betrayal to her community. It felt like a betrayal to the women whose rights she was trying to achieve justice. That was a tough moment, and we had no idea which way it was going to go. I won't say anything else because I don't want to.
Yeah, don't give too much away about it because it sort of turns, I think, on that moment. What were the difficulties making this film?
There were so many challenges in making this film, and challenges that turned into kind of beautiful creative inspiration. And I will say that though we had full access to the courts, and it was a process getting access from the various Qadi al-Qudas, the chief justices who changed multiple times in the film. There are three within the scope of our filming. As people would come in, I would ask, you know, are you comfortable being filmed for this documentary, et cetera, et cetera. And a lot of times people said yes, and a lot of times people said no.
I have to say, I was stunned by the people who had said yes, because we see some rather intimate moments, struggles between men and women as they're talking about the particulars of, you know, trying to dissolve their marriage and custody, and there's some anguish. And I mean, they were pretty vulnerable. I was surprised that they would allow you to film that.
Yes. In the times that we were fortunate enough to have full access, there were challenges in being in a room where mobility was restricted. I was in one corner of the room filming on a tiny DSLR camera, and there was a GoPro on the other side of the room. And the GoPro batteries would frequently die in the middle of a proceeding, and there's no way that you can run across to the other side of the room and switch batteries. And also, you know, throughout a proceeding, you're standing and sitting out of respect when people are swearing in the Quran and at various different parts. So, you know, it's not the most open environment to filming. But I will say, in the times that people said no, they were very generous to say, you can record my voice, but I want to preserve my likeness. I don't want my family to know that I was here.
Sure.
Please change my name. Or you can film my hands and my feet. And so this challenge came, how do we visually represent kind of the drama that's happening in the courtroom, which actually created some beautiful stylistic choices.
I was just going to say, it reminded me so much of the beautiful Iranian films that work with even more restrictive rules on what can be shown on film. And it gets very creative about what parts of the body you show to give what image. And it felt like that. It was really well done.
Oh, thank you. I will say another challenge that ultimately resulted in a beautiful moment was, I wanted to transport viewers into this unique experience of Palestine. Palestine is such a warm, beautiful, cultural mecca, and most of us will never get to experience that. So it was finding the details of, like, the insect noises and the car noises and that immersive experience. And one of the things I wanted to show was the aerials of Palestine. How do you visualize this? You can't put a drone up in the West Bank very easily because your mobility, your freedom of movement is so restricted by checkpoints and by the wall. So the only place that you can really put a drone up is in the middle of a city center or in the middle of villages. And I was fully prepared for people to come running out of their houses concerned about the kind of surveillance that was going on.
Of course. Mm-hmm.
You know, that's what you're exposed to as drones of surveillance. But instead, people came running out of their homes with cake and coffee saying, thank you so much for showing the world a Palestine that they've never seen before.
That's very Arab.
Yeah.
Can I say something about that? Since I just said Arab, I just wanted to say one thing about I love that. I love that it's presenting Palestine in a real way. I love that you saw her waving to aunties and uncles, you know, as she's walking through the street. I mean, these are the nuances that made her a real person. And I could tell she was part of her community. She wasn't helicoptering in from outside and trying to make change. She was definitely part of her world. And that world was a very loving and very family oriented one. It was really great.
Yeah.
I just wanted to add, she's not the first Muslim Sharia judge ever. I mentioned one in 10th century Baghdad, but she's also not the first in sort of the modern state era. There have been Muslim women Sharia judges in Malaysia since 2010. So I love that this was presented, but I do also want the audience to take away a realization that she's not the only one, and there's other cultures that have been okay with this in the Muslim majority world for even longer. And so we tend to Arabize the Muslim world, and there are Muslims all over the world, China, Bosnia, Africa, and Malaysia and Indonesia. So I just wanted to note that this is great that this is happening in Palestine, but it's been something that has been other women have been working on elsewhere as well.
Is it a trend? What are you seeing in terms of reform and the ideas of allowing women to to be judges on Sharia courts.
What I hope is that what you heard from the lawyers in that break room, I think it was that scene or maybe another one where they said, well, we weren't sure how she was going to be. But then after she did it for a while, we saw she was really quite good. So I hope that anyone who even has a cultural resistance, as it becomes normal and they see that these women are as good or better than the judges they're used to, it will become a non-issue. The pioneers are always having a harder time because they're breaking that initial resistance. But you know, as we all women who vote in this country know that, you know, it's now completely normal that no one would consider that you're not capable of making a decision like that. It's very non-issue. So that's what I hope. I don't know if it's a trend. It really depends on the reaction to these first ones. And in Palestine, she is the first. She and her friend are the first one. And it sounds like, seems from what I'm reading, I haven't been to Malaysia on this particular issue, but in Malaysia and Indonesia, it's become more normal and less of an issue.
Well, in this case, it doesn't hurt that she's a damn good judge, right?
Absolutely.
Well, you know, women have been judges in Indonesia for decades. But what I have seen is, you know, Khulud being the first in the Middle East, it's kind of opened up other doors for example, like Malaysia and India and UAE and the Sharia courts actually within Israel now have followed suit. So I think that her kind of global ripple effect will be continued to be felt not only within the Sharia courts, but within other women's leadership roles.
Erica Cohn directs the film The Judge, which opens tonight at the Broadway Center Cinemas in Salt Lake City. Erica will be on hand for the 7 o'clock screenings tonight and tomorrow night. There's going to be a Q&A there. We have links to all of that on our website, radiowest.org. We are also joined by Professor Asifa Qureshi Landis, specializes in Islamic and U.S. constitutional law. She teaches at the University of Wisconsin Law School. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Technical direction from Tim Slover. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.